busy, but it was more orderly. People were better behaved, I think, really. It was a bit of a scramble there, but it was one continual pressure. And I think the other thing about this issue, we didn't start trading till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, whereas the market around us was generally quiet, and I think everybody was getting prepared to trade in this mammoth issue.
Was that a decision of the stock exchange?
Yeah, well, it was. A lot of criticism at the time. It was done to combine with the opening in New York on the Wall Street Exchange. It was probably the first time it had ever been done that the stock exchange actually combined with another market in another country, as it were. But actually, looking back, I think it was probably much better that it was done that way, because all the general business could be done in a much more orderly fashion. I think to try and do everything at once would have caused a lot of chaos, really.
Well, could you continue describing the typical day in the early 60s?
Yes.
You went into the house at
9:30? 9:30, yes. We would get on with our general business and try and make business. One of the other things we also used to do was what was termed as the odds and sods. You'd get brokers who didn't know where to go with certain companies. Mm. And I built up a little bit of a knowledge of stocks that were traded in, say, at Southampton and places like this. So if somebody came around and said, "Oh, I can't find who trades in this one," I said, "Oh, I know a bit about that. I'll get you a price." So I had it was firm's business, but because the world was smaller in those days, I could get a price from a country broker who would get it from his client at Southampton, or another trader at Southampton. And I would then report back and say, "Well, there's such and such a price, and I might well do a trade on this." So it wasn't just sometimes waiting for business to come to you. You had to sort of try and make business. It was it wasn't always easy in that sense of the word. And then at 11:30, Father would go for his usual 11:30 drink. I would go to lunch in the early days at 10 to 12 and be expected to be back by 12:30.
Where would you go for lunch?
I'd probably go into Moore's across the road. They were either Sandwich or Birch's was another quite a favourite one. And if you were feeling a bit rich, you might go downstairs in Slater's. But that wouldn't necessarily be a regular situation. And the ironical thing is that Slater's has disappeared, Moore's and Birch's, they've all gone. They were quite big meeting places. And be back by 12:30. Father would probably decide to go to lunch then, leaving his other partner there. And then I would probably go down to get the marks the main thing was to keep yourself busy,
yes.
You know.
Could you explain?
And then about 1 o'clockish, you would start putting the bargains onto the checking sheets, get these and gradually keep those topped up till you got upstairs. But then when we got very, very busy, this was impossible. We had to start doing this when we got to the office at 3:30, because that was market shut at 3:30, and we would retire to the office. You'd have busy days and slack days, you couldn't never actually judge it. And yet there was always something going on. Either you people watch after a while, or your friends come round and you discuss how your holidays went, there was always something to do or say or talk about. And also, you'd see somebody pass, and you might be trying to do some business, and you say, "You used to be interested in such and such a stock. I can offer you 50,000 at so-and-so. I'll try that." And you, one in ten, you might score a bargain on that as a result of that. It was a lot of passing trading, in that way, making business.
Did you find yourself actively competing with other jobbers? Were you conscious that you were out there with the competition and that you had to try and do?
Not really, no. Because I think one always felt that if a broker came to you to try and do business, and if he was an unmarketable size, then you'd try jolly hard. Mm. In fact, we had, a good reputation. If we felt that we got no chance to do this broker's business at all, we wouldn't spoof him. We would say, "No, your best bet is to go and see so-and-so." Mm. Because there is a time you know which brokers have got the business or which job has got the business. And if a broker's left the business firm with another firm, then you're not going to see the business.
Mm.
Because any firm business left, that broker is not allowed to discuss that with any other member, nobody else in the market. So you've got no chance of doing that. Mind you, I did have a situation once, a seller of 1 million shares, and I knew the jobber that had the business, and I knew who his broker was, but I actually did my business with the other jobber. I asked to see him off the market floor, and said, look, I've got 1 million shares to sell at so-and-so. And anyway, as a result of that, I traded with him. It was knowing your market, really.
Mm.
It was, as I say, there was always something going on. Mm. Occasionally, as I sort of progressed a bit, I would be invited to lunches, and if they got clients or company directors going in who didn't fully understand the workings of the market, they had introduced a jobber to explain, you know, how it works or how it doesn't work.
Who ran these lunches? Were they
the brokers? Yes, but in the early days, I mean, it just wouldn't happen. It was most peculiar, and yet I've been to in the latter years, I've been to a jobber's office for lunch, which is when you turn the clock back to the 40s. I mean, it just never happened. It gradually changed through, and in the latter years, I think we had very good relationships with our opposition.
Mm.
I think we felt there was something mutually beneficial with it, not necessarily always financial, really.
Why do you think that did happen?
Because I think the world got larger. I think the stock market world, the international thing, got larger and larger. And I think we were all experiencing similar difficulties, and I think we were trying to find the best way around them, really.
Can you describe some of those difficulties?
Well, I think that when you were making close prices in large amounts of shares, and then stocks became sort of unmarketable, and markets would dry up, and it would be terribly it wouldn't be satisfactory at all to the brokers. So I think that we used to try and improve the market by having discussions and how can we do this? Because once you start taking away the marketability of stocks, then your turnover dries up, and your source of income can go. Also, when there was a new issue, the broker, I think this is probably what started it. A new issue, all the jobbers would read about it. You would then approach the jobber and say that I'm going to be very interested. I want to trade in this new company you're dealing in. It's a new hotel company, and it would fit in nice with ours. So, and then you have a meeting with the broker on the morning. There may be a week before you would meet the directors of the company, and they would try and explain what they're doing and how they're doing it, and introduce themselves and the business. And then on the morning of the issue, you would get called to the broker's box, and they would say, right, what's your ideas of prices? And you would openly discuss, well, we think they'll open around about £1. Have you agreed what the width of the price is? See, this is another thing that I think was fairly beneficial. You say, well, we think a 3p price is to start with. And the broker might say, well, I think that's a bit wide, so it might be adjusted into a 2-point price. And then he would give an indication what his limits were. And I think, really, it called for an orderly market. So that in the old days, when everybody rushed in, you really didn't know where you were, in a sense. But I think that the main emphasis was that orderly markets were most essential for everybody's point of view. Because you'll get a broker's picked the wrong jobber and he's dealt shilling wrong on the price, his client's not going to be too pleased about that. So I think it did have a lot of benefits. That's probably where jobbers first started really getting close together, I think, when they introduced this system of the early morning, you know, prayer meeting, if you like. But, it did work.
Were you ever involved in underwriting?
Yes, we used to take underwriting. never huge amounts of it, but we were always offered. I think they knew the size of our firm. They probably knew our capabilities, and obviously our underwriting was going to be totally different to somebody else's, which is something we always accepted. We never moaned about it. And I think that was probably that our attitude. We were never greedy, you know, in that sense of the word. In fact, I was absolutely amazed because on the British Telecom issue, it was the firm's, what we intended to do was to deal in all the new privatisations that were coming onto the market. And BT was the first one. And I remember approaching Hoare & Co and saying that it is our intention to take all these up. And so they duly noted it. And then we were called to some of the early discussions. And then he came round one morning in the market when everybody was talking about these premiums of 30 pence and 40 pence. Oh, he said, there's underwriting and you're getting a placing, but you automatically get some of the underwriting. It was a most complicated issue. And we actually finished up with something like 950,000 shares. And when you think that Aykroyd and Wed, all the large people, I think got 1.4 million, for a little tiny firm of our size to get 950,000 was absolutely amazing, because it was we got all these profits. But at the same time, I wasn't entirely happy with this, because whatever bargain you've got, you're still at risk. You know, my thoughts being that the cyber person I am, I was thinking, well, if anything happens to Maggie Thatcher or if another war breaks out, then, you know, it's pay and be paid with this sort of stock. It's all new issue bearer stock, which is you need to pay the next day, as it were, once it's been, you know, checked. But anyway, we accepted this underwriting, and you know, we did extremely well that year. But that's the biggest bargain I can actually remember, or biggest profit on one bargain. But and that, I think, was our relationship with the market. They knew what they felt we could afford, and underwriting in that sort of area. I think in the early days, the underwriting was money for jam, really, but it did have some bad ones. Fortunately, I don't think we ever turned any down, and I don't think we actually ever made any huge losses as a result of that. But it wasn't a big part of our, same as options. We used to take a bit of money on options in the early days, but it was never profitable. We never kept an eye on them enough, and it's a very specialised market. So we cut that one out.
How would takeovers worked in the old stock exchange?
Well, you would be approached by your favourite broker, and he would take you into his confidence and say, look, we want to build up a stake in these. How do you think we ought to go about it? And we'd say, well, there is a bit of stock around at the moment, but we suggest that you leave it to us and be flexible on the price. Don't just because you've bought them at a pound say you're not going to give more than a pound again. And depending on the size, we will recommend how you pick the stock up. And you might lay very quietly for perhaps 3 or 4 months, and you'd pick up a lot of stock for them. And then when they were prepared to move, then they would do so. But this is the advantage of a small firm like ourselves, you see. We were involved in, I think quite a few. I can't recollect any, but I can remember this was quite a common practice for us to be doing quite large business. And I think because that was how it worked. And also, we used to check outside the system as well. If we've done some very big business, it would never be done through the normal practice, on the basis that if something went wrong with it, then the bargain would get revealed. If somebody said, oh, there's a checking query on that million shares you bought yesterday, and then all of a sudden all the dealing box knows about this, and they suddenly realise that you've got some sort of operation on. So the bargains would be checked by a private letter between the partners. And that way it was all kept very, very low key.
Did you ever have cases where the news would get out something was on and all the other dealers would start adjusting their prices accordingly?
Can't remember of any leakages. It wasn't compulsory to mark your bargains. You didn't have to mark a bargain. Bargain marking was purely a voluntary basis. So if it was kept very tight, and everybody in our firm knew that if they ever disclosed any trade, any that went on within the firm, they'd be instantly dismissed, you know, which should be standard practice, really. Mm-hmm. No, I think because we were a small unit, I think our security was 2,000%, really. Mm-hmm. We've never had any problems there. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, because you were discreet, this is why you got the business, mm-hmm. you know. I think this is always an important factor. Mm-hmm. I think it was quite exciting, really. Especially when your friend's coming round to mind your eye, there's a big buyer in the market. Oh, you know, we would never see anything like that. We're too small. And you could hide, you know, under your own sort of cloak, as it were. Mm. Sometimes people normally have long memories, you know, about 2 or 3 months afterwards when it all comes out, they say, you knew, didn't you? Well, we're not going to disclose our broker's business. He's not going to thank us for it. But it was quite exciting. Mm. A satisfaction as well, because you've done the broker's business, you know, and he's helped the client, and he's going to come back again, really. Mm.
Would brokers normally have a favourite jobber that they'd normally take their business to, or did they shop around?
There obviously were brokers had their favourite jobbers. But at the same time, the large firms would say, right, we will leave this business firm with Smith Brothers for 3 months, if they've got a really big operation on, and then at the end of 3 months they would take that business off and then go and give it to another jobber, and which I think is correct, because you can't do all your business with one man, because there's going to come a time when you want to go and deal in a company that your favourite jobber doesn't trade in, and they say, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to help you. Mm. So you should really spread your business around a little bit, I think. Mm. I don't think it matters today. I think it's the way the screen trading goes. I think you can do your business anywhere. There's no loyalty, I think, left, or if it is, it's very, very tiny to what it used to be in the old days. Changing times, I suppose, really.
Let's go back now, again, to this typical day that you were describing some time ago. You said that the house would close at 3:30 and you would go back to the office. What would go on then?
Well, you'd finished putting all your bargains in on the check-in sheets. Then the most important thing then was to agree your positions. Mm. So take your bull and bear book, which is your overnight position, and then you would take the difference on the day's trade and work that out from the overnight position, and it had to agree with the position in the jobbing book. Most bargains that we did, you would finish up with a position at the end, and that was altered on every bargain. And you never went home at night until you've agreed your position. I mean, it would be... It might appear to be 1,000 shares out, it could be 1,000,000 shares out, on a large basis. Some firms, I don't know, Father always used to say, there was one firm, Frisbee Brothers, used to agree their positions every 3 months, but, you know, it horrified me. We not only used to take the positions out, we used to take our profit and loss out every night as well. So by 5:00 we knew exactly our positions in the book were true, correct. And we also knew that we'd made a profit or a loss that day by 5:00, and tomorrow was another day.
Then you'd go home.
Yes. It depending on what sort of day. I mean, I've been in the office till. In fact, I can remember one day we had a very, very quiet day, and then suddenly at 5:00 we started doing a lot of business in GRA, and we were still there at 7:00 that night trading.
That was over the phone.
Over the phone. Yeah. Mm. No screens or anything like that. This was, you know, the early days. If the business was there, you'd stay. I mean, it was. If there was nothing about, then 5:00, you would go home if it was a normal day. But you always had to be flexible.
Yes. Would you have people coming to the office? Would you ever have brokers calling in, or journalists?
Very few. Journalists, yes. You'd have the odd journalist. But in the early days, we didn't have a lot of connections with the journalists. They weren't always welcome, I don't think, in the early days.
Why was that?
Well, they would come round and pump you for information, which might be delicate in any case, which you're not prepared to tell them. and invariably some of them would print whatever you told them, they'd print whatever they wanted to print. Mm. So it was always might not be the right slant on it. Mm.
But you say that.
And if
changed.
You were quoted, if you were quoted, well then you're now being indiscreet towards your brokers and your and to the perhaps the directors of the company that you've been friendly with. Mm. I think it was sometimes quite counterproductive. Mm.
Did that change? You said in the early days they were unwelcome.
Well, there was a time, yes. Then there was the good days. I think when we did we would ring them up and perhaps meet them, have a bit of lunch, or say the story that was printed in whatever the paper was incorrect. This is the correct one, and they were more than likely print it.
Did they regard you as a, you being jobbers generally, as a good source of information?
Yes. Oh yes. Mm. I mean the ones that really respected us, we would say, well, I'm sorry, we can't comment on it. It's difficult at the moment, and they would just leave you alone. Mm. But the classic one was a chap called Westrop with the Sunday, I think he was the Sunday Express. And they started buying Butlins and Pontins on the Wednesday. And it continued on the Friday, on the Thursday and the Friday. And I remember Father writing up on the dealing board, buy Butlins and Pontins, see Sunday Express. And lo and behold, Sunday Express came out and tipped Butlins and Pontins. And Westrop phoned up on the Monday, how dare we do this? And Father said, well, it was true. What was wrong with it? Father said, you've got a leakage in your office. He said, the buyers came in from Wednesday onwards. And he said, it's not on. He said, I haven't put anything on the board that wasn't true. Well, it's been very embarrassing and there's no leakages from this office. So he said, well, we ought to meet and discuss what we can do about it. So I remember going round with Father. We met in Birch's in Angel Court, and we had this discussion on how we were going to sort this problem out. And Father said, well, your best bet is to put a fictitious stock. You write the article as you would normally write it, leave it on your desk or whatever you do, and we'll see what the reaction is. So he said to Father, well, what stock would you recommend? He said, well, I don't know. What about Bellevue Manchester, which happened to be a stock where we had quite a few shares on the book. So he promptly wrote the article, and Wednesday they came in to buy the stock, and on the Thursday and on the Friday and Sunday, no article. they were all looking very puzzled on Monday morning, and I don't know that it entirely stopped it, but we certainly got some of our money back on that one. Yeah. But that was the only time I've ever known what I call full cooperation to try and stop the leakages. But they were quite rife in the 40s. But I think they were more sophisticated because if they were going to write a stock up, they'd normally probably pick the penny stocks, but they would buy them 3 or 4 weeks before. Mm. And they would be genuine. It's not as if they were puffing what I call rubbish. You know, they were perhaps a stock that had been overlooked and needed to be brought to people's attention. Mm. But rather than buy them on the Wednesday and sell them on Monday morning, they would buy the stock and put it away for several weeks, perhaps.
Now, when you say they, who do you mean?
Well, that would be a broker who worked fairly closely with perhaps the newspaper editors. Mm. I'm going back again to the 40s, you see, the 40s and the 50s. Mm. Oh, it was, you know, to know what Mr. Bearball was going to write up, that was in the Investor's Chronicle, I think it was, which came out on Fridays. If you knew what Mr. Bearball was going to write up, you know, you could always make a few pounds out of that. Mm. Oh, it was. And the strange thing was that some brokers used to come in to buy a modest 5,000 shares, and it was always the same sort of timing. And you knew jolly well that there was going to be a mention. And you could pick the paper out on the Sunday. But because he bought this 5,000 shares and didn't make a big fuss of it, as far as the market maker is concerned, he's had his card marked. Mm. And that was acceptable because now you could, without being too loud about it, you could try and get your book a bit right and not do anything too silly. So it did have its benefits. But they were really a bit over the top, though, I think, looking back in the old days.
Well, did you feel there were any other things that were slightly disreputable going on in what you call the old days?
No, I think it was. I think the biggest culprits were the Sunday paper tips. I think they had such an influence on the market. I mean, they just wouldn't move three halfpence or threepence. They would probably move shillings a share, which was and you're going back in the days when there wasn't any capital gains tax in those days, so it was it was quite a profitable thing to do. I can't ever really recall anything else. I think that was probably the, and in a way it seemed to be acceptable because nobody ever seemed to do anything about it. You couldn't actually prove anything, and there was always one rule which I always reminded Father about, was that no bargain can be cancelled unless it's mutually agreed by all parties. So even when there was an inquiry. And we know the chap's been a rogue. It's still, the bargain won't get cancelled. The only time we had bargains, they were never cancelled, they were frozen. And it was the first time, I think, in the history of the Stock Exchange, when Adrian Jacobs, who was Mr. X, was, this probably is the other instance. Adrian Jacobs was allegedly dealing across the market. And he would get broker A to come to the jobber and say that broker B will have some business in this stock and he will be a buyer. So I can offer you 100,000 shares at 10p, and the other broker would come in and say, well, I understand that you've got a seller in these, I can give you 11p. So the bargain would be done across the market, two different brokers. And he would gradually, this stock would be put through the jobber over a period of time, and eventually the same stock would be traded at perhaps at 4 or 5 shillings a share. And there were several of these stocks. There was about five in all. Ours was Lincoln, our stock, and there was Grahamstown Gas was another one, and they were always in a market where there wasn't a market, always in a company with a very limited market. So these two brokers would gradually keep putting the stock through until they got the price up to a certain height, and then the broker would deliver the stock onto the and then not pay for them. So rather, the chap that bought the stock would refuse to pay for them. In fact, it finished the firm. So the seller got paid because the liability in those days came back onto the jobber. If the broker can't pay, then it comes back onto the market maker. So this chap got paid out in full, all the stocks that he'd gradually worked up. He got paid out in full, and the jobbers got left with high and dry with the valueless stocks at the end of the day.
Did they get hammered?
No, none of the jobbers got hammered. Hansford, I think, was the name of the firm. They ceased trading. And RH Bristow, they got hammered. I think they got hammered. And we had to pay for the stock. But the bargains were frozen, and while the Stock Exchange looked into what was happening, and as in Lloyd's, they always pay up on, doesn't matter, whatever. The Stock Exchange attitude was pay and be paid, so we had to pay up and take the stock, which it was a complete write-off, really.
Were you eventually able to get rid of the stock?
I don't think we did. I think the stock finally ceased to trade. I think the company's wound up. It was a very clever operation, really, but in fact, the major jobbers then insisted that any put-throughs done in the market, they wanted to know their clients were. I mean, there was an old saying, a put-through is money for jam, but on a put-through, the market maker or the jobber has got the full liability both ways. So what appears to be, this farthing a share on a quarter of a million, which looks absolutely marvellous, but if you've got to pay for the stock that's valueless, it just doesn't really cover it at all.
Can you remember roughly when this happened?
I guess it's in the 60s, I think, this one. It's got to be on record in the Stock Exchange.
Yes. But it was roughly then, during
I think the 1960s. Yeah, I think it's in the 60s. Mm. I'm certain that the stock exchange on record have got when they ceased trading.
Mm. How did your firm develop? Now, you started trading as S. Jenkins & Son in 1960 and continued right up until 1986, and then you were registered as a market maker.
Yeah.
Did the firm develop in any particular way during that 26 years, or did you stay more or less the same size, deal more or less the same size bargains?
We remained the same. Well, I think we got larger. I think the bargains got larger because the market got larger. I don't think there was any doubt about that. In fact, we were the market in quite a few of the companies, and we competed on very even terms with our larger competitors. In fact, when the firm shut down, the opposition knew which dealers they wanted because they knew where the business was being done. And I think we had quite a good reputation on size. In fact, I think we were larger in size than some of our big opposition. They just didn't want to know. Mm. I think when the firm shut down, I think personally, and this is not sour grapes, I think this really did affect the third market.